target. Got within 30 miles of that moon, and actually went through the plume, to detect the minerals coming off the surface. That was Enceladus, Enceladus, as they pronounce it, Enceladus. So, but Jupiter's a different story. We had Galileo for years, and eventually they deorbited Galileo after about 5-6 years, and they crashed out into the Jupiter atmosphere. They didn't want to contaminate the moon. Let me drop it. Now, 2016, probably in the summer, I guess, we have the Juno spacecraft going to go into orbit around Jupiter, polar orbit. It'll be 33 orbits. And then they'll investigate magnetic field and all of that. But, they don't have any plans on that. There's no landers or anything on that. And that's all solar panel. I'm looking forward to that mission. Getting there. Europa Express, we've got to wait probably 2022, something like maybe 2024. Got a long wait before that happens. Back to that.
Okay. So got some interesting spacecraft coming up, though. A lot of things to look forward to. I guess my favorite one is the infrared telescope. Going to be launched in 2018. I keep forgetting the name of the darn thing. James Webb, who is a former administrator for NASA, as I remember. Out of curiosity, Paul, is James Webb a silent key, or is he still alive and kicking?
He was a real push for the Apollo program, and he really wanted to. Really wanted to, all the astronauts and everything to be safe, but he gets at the same time he wanted them to get there. And he pushed Congress left and right to do that, and he was a good administrator. So not a lot of good administrators in NASA. It was a pretty good one. Back to you.
Is James Webb still alive, do you think?
He died. I guess the family will get to see his name live on. Hope it's a success. Not like Cygnus went up, the cargo ship that was launched by Orbital Science just recently. And that was launched by an Atlas V. And Cygnus spacecraft, when they go up, they have a Orbital Science likes to name it after past astronauts. They picked different astronauts, Janet Voss and a couple of the other ones. The one that blew up back in 2 Octobers ago was named after Deke Slayton. Deke Slayton was one of the original astronauts. So it went up and it blew up. They never figured on that. So what they did is this last one that went up on the Atlas V, they renamed it Deke Slayton too. So at least he finally, his name finally got to go to the space station. Back in that WS2N.
I told you guys a few times that I met Deke Slayton 1971-72 when I was down at Houston, and he was in charge of astronaut training at the time. And I was there. I got invited there because of the Apollo 15 listening that we did at AIL. And Deke Slayton was not happy to meet me because considered the NASA Deep Space Network very high technology private communication channel between him and his astronauts on the Apollo program when they're in the lunar vicinity, and didn't think very many facilities around the world were capable of doing that. And this antenna of ours, our 12-foot antenna, was listening to astronaut audio when they're on the high-gain antenna on Apollo while they're in the orbit around the moon, or when they're on the lunar surface. When they're on the high-gain antenna, I could hear them with my 12-foot dish. On the Omni, no. Only Goldstone could hear them. But, as I said, he was unhappy to meet me because, from his point of view, I was taking his private communication channel and turning it into a party line. Let me drop it. Now, to answer that earlier question about what did I see in my backyard, this all came about because I was using my binoculars, standing on the ground, looking at the top of my tower, looking at various antennas and mounting brackets, coax cables, decided the next time I climbed the tower, what tools do I have to bring in order to do the next step of the construction, improvement, correction, and so on. So I'm studying the tower with binoculars, and behind the tower, I see these two objects. And the two objects were metallic gray in color, hamburger shaped, where the meat of the hamburger was a dark area that looked like windows, but the gray of the two craft was identical to the gray sky that day. This was 1995, 3 o'clock in the afternoon in August. So 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, two gray spacecraft have the exact same color as the background of the sky. The reason I could so easily see them is that they were in front of a white cloud from my point of view. And with the binoculars, I could see these two craft very easily. Without the binoculars, I could not see them. By way of the binoculars, I've got a priori knowledge that there were two objects there. And with the naked eye, I could barely tell that there were two dots against the sky. I never would have found them with the naked eye. But with these 7x35 binoculars, they showed up quite nicely.
And repeater, time out.
And these two objects were absolutely motionless. They were separated by, oh, let me pick a number, 5 times the diameter of one of these objects was the approximate spacing, maybe 10 times, but in that order. And they were offset at a 45-degree angle, one higher than the other. I vaguely remember the one on the right-hand side was lower and the one on the left-hand side was higher, but absolutely motionless. I watched them for about 2 minutes, and I go running inside and grab my son and my wife, saying, "You gotta see this." And I hand my son the binoculars, and he says, "Wow." And he's studying them. He's got a better set of eyes than I do, so he saw a lot more details. When he draws a picture of what he saw, it's a lot more detailed than I remember. My wife wasn't quite sure what she was seeing. She had trouble focusing the binoculars. She knew something was there, but she didn't quite make it out. So we're tossing the binoculars back and forth among the three of us. And this whole incident took place for 20, 25 minutes. Absolutely no motion of this spacecraft. Completely steady. If I had to make a guess, I would say they were a couple of miles away from me. If I had to make a guess, I would say they were, 1,500 foot in diameter. And as I said, very close to a hamburger shape. Let me drop. Now, I'm a member of the microwave, what is it now called? Microwave list. In other words, there's a group of guys that sent emails back and forth for the last 10, 15 years, headed up by Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, has this list service by which anything you send to that list gets distributed to all 150 or 200 members worldwide, serious microwave ham radio operators. And somebody one day got into the subject of insects on their towers, hornet nests and things like that that formed on their towers. Let me drop. So that was a subject which created quite a thread of people describing various birds, insects, whatever, that were building nests on their towers. And I also had a hornet's nest that was built into my tower one day at the 60-foot level, and quite difficult to remove, because when I finally discovered them, they had been there for quite a long time, and they had filled up the space between the three bars of a row number 6 tower. So it was a good-sized hornet's nest. got on the subject of what we've seen on our towers of various kinds of animals, insects, birds, and I also went and described on this Lucerne the two hamburger objects. And that created quite a bit of email to me. About five guys described to me the things that they have seen in the sky that are very difficult to explain. Could call them UFOs. But a couple of people gave me an awful lot of slack. One very good guy I know very well in Texas gave me an awful lot of slack, saying, "How in the world do you think you saw something like that? You're misinterpreting." To which I told him about the book that I was reading at the time, well, I've read a few years ago. I've forgotten the exact title, but it's something like, all of a sudden I can't think of the name of the town in
Roswell?
Witness at Roswell. And I think the name of the book is Witness at Roswell. And when you read that book, you realize that these two reporters spent 10 years of their life interviewing people in Roswell, New Mexico. And boy, there's an awful lot of people that all saw something very similar. So if it's a hoax, my goodness, it's a very well done hoax. And that hoax, to explain it as a weather balloon, really doesn't hang true. A weather balloon is not going to make a 500-foot gash in the ground. And to remove the hardware of a weather balloon is not going to take a flatbed truck, a flatbed trailer, something like 20 feet long and with a top wind over that's about 8 foot high. That's not a weather balloon. So an awful lot of people saw something. So I took this book, Witness at Roswell, and mailed a copy of it to my buddy in Texas, who is extremely strongly of the belief that that was only a weather balloon, and all these objects that people have seen in the sky are a misinterpretation, swamp gas or whatever. I told him, "I want you to read this book and tell me which chapter has the most amount of error from your point of view." I've never heard an answer from him since. He's been kind of quiet ever since. So maybe he's, after all these years of being so sure, maybe he's entertaining another possibility. So, as I said, this incident with three members of my family watching it for 20, 25 minutes, and what ended the incident, they didn't fly away. The cloud drifted. When the cloud drifted so that they were no longer against a white cloud.
Repeater, time out.
When these two hamburger-shaped objects with the exact same gray metallic coloring as the way the sky was that day, when the cloud moved, they were no longer visible. We lost sight of them. Whether they flew away at that exact instant of time, I don't know. But 20, 25 minutes later, we could no longer see them. And as I said, a number of other hams had a similar incident, looking at the tower with a set of binoculars, or looking at the tower at nighttime, and saw things in the sky that are very difficult to explain. So I got a number of letters from those guys saying, right on, but they were privately sent to me, not sent through the listserv, realizing that people will give you a lot of flack. I get some pretty strong flack on that one. So privately, people told me they agree. Publicly, a couple of people told me, "You're crazy." And my family is crazy because they were all being brainwashed by me. I think even you have seen some things in the sky that are a little bit difficult to explain. Isn't that true, John? KC2WGB, KQIW in the TechNet. KCWGB?
Yeah, I've seen a few very strange things that I couldn't explain. I think I explained one to you last year, I think it was. Looked like a star, but it was moving, and it made a right angle turn at quite a high speed. Now, how does that happen? Don't know. I also saw what that was. What this is, I have no idea. It was seven orbs in a row, separated by maybe it was high in the sky. They were approximately, I'd say, 5 miles apart. There was seven of them. They weren't moving. They were just there. Could have been something because of the sun angle or whatever. Don't know. but they also showed up on film. I have no idea what they were.
So I think you're saying you took pictures and you've got a print or you've got a slide of those things that you saw, John?
Actually, it was a video. We had a video camera. It was a party. We were out in somebody's yard. I happened to look up and I saw that, and they pointed the camera up there, and it showed up on the camera, too. So they were absolutely there.
What time of year and what time of day? Was it nighttime, daytime, summer, winter? When during the day and when during the year was the sighting, John Dredd?
It was in the summertime, August, I believe, and it was around 2 p.m., and we were having a little barbecue, and that was it. Yeah, it was August. I remember that because we were cool and everything. Crazy stuff.
Yeah, if I had to try to speculate as to what these two hamburger-shaped objects were doing, 3 o'clock in the afternoon in August on Sunday, why were they sitting absolutely still? My guess was that if you want to observe human beings, to color yourself identical to the sky means you're essentially invisible, and to sit absolutely steady 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, you're going to see the maximum number of people outdoors doing something. Mowing their lawn, cooking a barbecue, swimming at a beach. 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday in August, you get the maximum number of people outside and you can observe them. That's a pure guess on my part as to what possibly was taking place. Anybody have any further questions or comments on my sighting that not everybody agrees with? I can understand that. K2RIW listening.
Also, Dick, they were shaped like an ellipse, sort of like an eye. They sort of tailed out at the end. But they were all the same shape and roughly the same size. Strange stuff.
And once again, John, how many of them and what kind of a formation?
They were in a sloping formation, 7 of them all together, and they were at about a 30-degree angle from my point of view, sloping down from the highest one to the lowest one. It looked like they were about, I'd say, 5 miles apart.
And once again, roughly how many?
It's exactly 7 that could be seen.
And you were at a barbecue or some other kind of a party. How many people at that party witnessed this? And who owns that video recording, John? Go ahead.
The guy who has that video is actually in Florida now. He's retired. But everybody at the barbecue saw them. And it was amazing. Nobody questioned them like, oh, okay. What do they think? It was puffs of smoke? I mean, these things were definitely defined. I don't know if they were structures. They may have just been funny-shaped clouds or something. But no way to explain it. Don't forget about your four-year concept you want to talk about.
WS2N.
Yeah, before I go over to Paul, how long did the sighting last, John?
About 25 minutes. Not just short of a half hour.
And during that half hour, what kind of motion took place?
Absolutely no motion. They were dead still.
More observers. On a Sunday afternoon, in your case, 2 o'clock in the afternoon in August. Too bad things like that don't happen in Ronkonkoma. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
John's experience, it sounds like a real thing, but yours, couldn't it be, if it was the same color as the sky, couldn't it be like two holes in the clouds? You know, where you're looking through a hole in the clouds, so that would look like the object. I wonder if that's a possibility. And in Ronkonkoma, well, I sat in a parking lot one time. Actually, it was Burger King, looking due west. And it was light in the sky, beautiful blue sky, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock at night. It was getting a little dusk, and this was not a star, it was not Venus, due west, and, you know, quite a long time. So, as I'm sitting there, I thought, well, if the Earth is turning, that should be setting. It should be going down. But as time went on, it was rising up little by little because, you know, I was using a wire going across the street as a guide, and this thing is going up, going the opposite way of something setting. So I thought that was strange, but I don't know what it was. Could have been a balloon or something for all I know. Back to you, Dick. I wonder if there was possible, if there was holes through the clouds and you're looking at the background. Back to you, Dick.
To have such a sharp edge and such a distinct shape and a pair of them lasting for 25 solid minutes. Yes, you can get a hole in the cloud, but it ain't going to last for more than a few seconds, half a minute maybe. To last a pair of identical shaped objects with a very distinct outline.
Were they both the same size?
Absolutely identical in size. Absolutely identical color, shape. I mean, you've got this upper gray hamburger bun, lower gray hamburger bun, and a dark area, a horizontal dark area between the two that my son says looked to him like windows. I didn't see them that distinctly. To him, they look like windows, a row of windows around the equator of these upper and lower hamburger shells. The two of them are identical in size, identical in color, identical in every way, except that they were separated horizontally and vertically. About a 45-degree angle is the slant, so to speak. As I remember, the left-hand one higher, the right-hand one lower, and separated by, oh, I'm going to make a guess, 5 or 10 hamburger diameters was the distance between them. For a hole in the cloud to stay that steady, the 25 solid minutes with absolutely no motion, even though the cloud was moving. But they did not move. With reference to the tower, absolutely no motion. And I could tell that my Parallax, let me drop this.
And you never found any information of this being mentioned by anywhere, anyhow. No newspapers, TV reports?
Nope, no other reporting. Joe, I was the only... Me and my family are the only people seeing it. Without binoculars, you wouldn't see it at our particular direction. But I could shift my head left and right, and by the parallax of looking the way they moved with reference to the tower, from my point of view, they were at a long distance away compared to the distance between me and my tower. I mean, if I was looking at the moon in the background, so to speak, and I'm looking at the moon from my tower, and I shift my head left and right, I know the way the moon would appear to move compared to the tower. These things had that characteristic. So, you got some further questions on this one, Joe? The B2RYY, K2RIW?
The first thing is not any information on it mentioned by anybody at that particular time. What time was that again? You meant this, yeah, I think you mentioned it previously, something like, you know, quite a few years ago, right?
Yeah, for me it was 1995, August, Sunday, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So that makes it 25 years ago. Back to you, Joe.
Okay. I'm guessing you've also tried to internet this thing, either by Google or some other means, like sightings over Long Island, at that particular time to see if anybody else somewhere, somehow, saw the same thing at the same time. Did you try that at all? Just out of curiosity.
Two blimps, Dick. Two big blimps.
Hamburger-shaped blimps, identical. Absolutely no motion for 25 solid minutes. When I say no motion, I didn't, but I think I could have counted which rung of the tower was the slant angle. And absolutely no change for 25 solid minutes. You would think you're looking at a picture, so to speak, but the picture had a funny kind of parallax. As you moved around and you compared these things with reference to the radio tower, you knew that you're looking at objects at a long distance away. But if you and I tried to make a helicopter hover that steady for 25 solid minutes, you couldn't do it. I can't think of any kind of an aircraft that could sit that steady, rock steady, for 25 solid minutes. No change in shape, no change in position, no change in altitude, no change in spacing, no change in coloring, no tilt, no nothing. K2RIW listening.
You know, Dick, with the Earth's rotation, you went through about 7 degrees, so evidently they were moving in synchronous fashion.
No. All they have to do is sit steady over a particular point on the ground. My tower is not moving with reference to the ground. I'm not moving with reference to the ground. They were not moving with reference to the ground. John, go ahead.
Well, being that you had the tower and you knew the distance between the tower and the object, the tower was moving in that 7 degree motion. They had to be moving with it. Or maybe the fact that they were so far away, it wasn't apparent.
That is correct, Mr.
I am guessing they were a relatively small number of miles away from me here, John. But I have nothing to reference it to, so I can't be sure. They were not just 50 miles away, because if they were 50 miles away, they would have to be thousands of feet in diameter for me to see them at the angular spread that I did. Now, they're some small number of miles away from me. I could estimate what town over eastern Long Island they were over, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yeah, extremely interesting sighting. And you've got a lot of facts there that you observed. And it is, like, it's very difficult to explain these things. I have no clue what I saw. I was saying maybe there was some kind of element in the air that was reflecting the sun rays or obscuring the sun rays. I have no idea, but, you know, you just wonder about it, and what's the point? You know, it's just wild stuff.
Yep. Not easy to explain. But, as I said, in my case, I don't expect many people to say that they saw it, because at least from where I was standing, without binoculars, you never would have found them. I only found them because I'm looking at the tower with binoculars. I sure wish a higher power telescope would have been available to me at that time. I didn't have my current telescope at that time. That would have been a lot of fun. If they sit still long enough. And if they were watching me, would they still sit steady when they see the glint of a telescope, the forward correcting lens on a Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope? When that glints back at them, would they still sit steady? What do you think, John? K2RIW.
Good question, Dick. If they knew they were being observed, they may have left. But another thing, the orbs that I saw didn't travel anywhere. They just disappeared. That was another thing that was strange. They were there, and then they weren't there. Weird.
Were you looking at them at the instant they winked out? Did they just sort of wink out, or... You took your eyes off them, talked to somebody in the crowd, then looked back and they weren't there? Is that what happened, John? Go ahead.
No, I was observing them at the end when they disappeared, right in front of my eyes. It was like they evaporated. They definitely didn't move from what I could see, but they just faded out, and I would say it probably took less than 2 seconds from their normal density to nothing in 2 seconds, or maybe even less.
So maybe it takes 1.5 seconds to turn on the cloaking device, John.
Yeah, they probably said, "Look, that idiot's looking at us. Let's disappear." But I always enjoy these things, and you know, you're crazy, I'm crazy. Everybody sees this stuff as nuts, but I don't know. I know I saw it, and everybody else did, so I know it's not my eyes.
Yeah, starting a couple of weeks ago, I was mentioning the fact that we could discuss Fourier series, Fourier transforms, refraction. I know that Roy, AT2GS, thinks that we should mention the fact that what the ionosphere does to a radio signal is refraction. We can overly simplify and say it was an ionospheric reflection, but the ionosphere really is a plasma-like cloud at very high altitude. I believe it's primarily created by ultraviolet rays from the sun hitting the very low density material in the upper atmosphere. Let me drop it. And so ionization means that you've made a plasma. The energy of those X-rays hitting those molecules up high are separating the electrons from the nucleuses of those atoms. Therefore, you've created a conducting plasma. The radio wave hits that cloud of conducting plasma, which has a higher dielectric constant. It's got conductivity. It's got all kinds of crazy properties to it. And a radio signal goes into it and gets refracted. Refracted is the best way of putting it. The material has the equivalent of a different dielectric constant. So therefore, whether your light wave goes into a magnifying glass and gets changed in direction, or whether it goes into a plasma cloud that we call the ionosphere and gets changed in direction, there's a degree of similarity here with a storefront window. Let me drop it. If you're looking at the big chunk of glass in a storefront window, but you're looking at it at a grazing angle, you realize you get a much higher coefficient of reflection. It has more mirror-like characteristics at a grazing angle. The ionosphere is also like that. When the radio wave hits this cloud at a grazing angle, you get a signal deflection that brings it back down to Earth after it's been through that cloud, or been through the outer layer of that cloud, so to speak. And it only happens at a grazing angle. Except for certain frequencies, if you hit the cloud straight up, don't get anywhere near as much reflection. The signal doesn't bounce off the cloud and come straight down at most of the frequencies we care about. Near vertical incident, sky or reflection, what is that called now? Yes, at certain frequencies that does happen. But there's a maximum usable frequency. As you go up in frequency, you've got to be closer and closer to a grazing angle to get this deflection, this change in direction, such that it gets brought back to Earth, and therefore you can talk to somebody, let me pick a number, 1,000 miles away. You can tell that because it's occurring at a grazing angle, let me drop it. And because what you and I see at a grazing angle from a storefront window, we call it in the storefront window reflection. If that storefront consisted of a highly polished, shiny piece of metal, the signal that bounces off of that, we would definitely call that a reflection. But when it is a piece of dielectric material called glass, which has got a certain refractive index, is that reflection or is that refraction what you get off the storefront window? Is there a degree of similarity? Well, there's a lot of difference here. The storefront window is not a ionized cloud. It's not a plasma. So maybe that really is reflection. But that ionosphere here, it doesn't have a clearly defined, sharp edge to it like the glass of the storefront window does. The glass has a very sharp front surface. So I think the storefront window, even though it's a dielectric, non-metallic material, non-conducting material, we can call that a reflection. A real mirror is a metallic, shiny object that does give you a nice reflection. Is that chunk of glass at a grazing angle, is that a reflection or is that refraction? You got a guess on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Nick, I think there's some refraction involved because of the depth of the glass and the different parts that are responding to the light wave. Now, you take a mirror surface mirror, okay, we could call that reflection. But when that mirror surface is placed in the rear of the glass, now we have a twofold example of both reflection and refraction, in my view. Back to you.
Coming.
I agree with you on that one. Wes, go ahead.
In spectroscopy, there's a technique that is being used where they assign you the crystalline of crystals, and that is being achieved by directing X-rays by a very a close angle to the surface of the crystal. So my understanding is that we're dealing with photons, ladies and gentlemen. When we're dealing with the photons, then the more rays, like you said, the angle is, the more chances for the radio wave or the light or the photon by itself to reflect, not refract. And the depth of the reflection is, or the depth of the penetration is smaller with the closest angle to the surface of the glass. And to achieve it.
Were you discussing X-ray diffraction with those crystals, Wes? Go ahead.
Correct. So, there is a requirement for a certain angle, the refraction to happen, but if you don't obey that angle and you make it more close to the surface of the crystalline, then you have a reflection, not refraction. In other words, the depth of the penetration is smaller with the closer angle. And to actually,
I know that X-ray diffraction photography was a significant step in resolving what was going on in the DNA molecule. Can't think of the lady's name that had taken that photograph that was handed to the guy who is accredited with figuring out what the double helix really looks like. Watson, I guess his name is. And that that photograph of the X-ray diffraction of a DNA molecule was handed to him, and he was able to interpret it and eventually figured out what the structure of the DNA helix was like. My impression of X-ray diffraction is that the X-rays are acting as individual particles that are striking individual particles of the crystal and being scattered, and the scattering diagram, the scattering pattern, tells you something about the location of the original particles that are in that crystal, or in the case of the DNA, in that molecule. There's a characteristic scattering diagram that tells you what the original structure was like. It's not a photograph. It's very far from a photograph. It's much more difficult to interpret. But if you're smart enough, the raw data is there. That's what I think X-ray diffraction is. K2RIW, are you listening?
Bragdell. When X-rays are scattered from the crystal lattice peaks of scattered intensity observed, which correspond to the following conditions. I'm reading. The first, angle of incidence equals angles of scattering. Number two, the path length difference is equal to the integral number of wavelengths. And to achieve.
So it sounds to me like X-ray diffraction of a crystal and where the individual molecules are located within that crystal has a little bit of the characteristic of a phased array antenna. Your phased array antenna has individual emitting objects called the elements of the phased array, which are separated by an integral number of wavelengths in the usual design, quite often a fraction of a wavelength, and the phase angle of the signal emitted by the individual elements determines the way you construct a wave that eventually gets emitted by this great big thing called phased array. There are people who think they misinterpret a phased array antenna, thinking it consists of individual antennas aimed in various directions. That's not it at all. Let me drop it.
You're right. You're talking about constructive and destructive interference.
That's one way of looking at it. In certain directions, the signals emitted by all of the elements and their particular amplitude and phase angles, which is really called the steering matrix. So you're deciding as a designer that each of your elements, which have a certain address in three-dimensional space, are going to be emitting a signal. Each one has its own selected amplitude and own selected phase. Phase is the main thing that does the steering. And all of those individual signals from the individual elements become a constructive interference in a particular direction, which you might call the foresight, where you've decided to aim the signal from that phased array at this instant of time. So the constructive interference of a phased array antenna and the constructive interference, Bragg cell-like constructive interference of X-ray diffraction of a crystal, have some pretty strong similarity. Is that what you're saying, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW?
Yeah, that's exactly. The atomic planes of the crystals was an incident beam of X-rays treated other with one other, and they leave as they leave the crystal. So the phenomenon is called X-ray diffraction. Talking about the constructive interference in phase and out of phase, in one we we could see the increase of the amplitude and decrease of the amplitude. One of the cases sent to X-ray.
Now here's a question. Is there a slight relationship between the scattering you get with X-ray diffraction scattering and the way you record what took place and the principle of operation of a hologram? In the case of a hologram, you have a kind of a three-dimensional photograph which consists of individual, let me call them dots in the various layers of the, what I'm going to call the photograph of the hologram. And when you shine coherent light on it, the reflection off those individual dots becomes constructive and destructive in certain directions. And when the human eye puts it all together, you see it as a three-dimensional picture. But there's a degree of similarity, I think, between a hologram, a phased array antenna, and X-ray diffraction. Do you see any possible relationship there, Wes, into X-JN, K2RIW?
Okay, I'm not good in holograms, but my understanding is, and I would love if John maybe Rory is available. Well, let's say we have material, right? We measured the average spacing between the layers and the rows of the atoms, and then we determine the orientation of the typical crystal or ray. Then we find the crystal structure of that, say, unknown material. Then we measure the size, shape, and the internal stress of the small crystal region. And then four, if we want to create a tri-dimensional picture, we are actually looking about at angle of the incidence. We are looking at that material in regard to its thickness. Let me drop. So, and that would be good because I'm just taking it out of my mind and I'm not familiar with holograph. The first layer shows us the picture in let's say, angle X. Now we're moving our eyes to angle X plus 10 degrees. Now we don't see the first layer, we see the second layer. The second layer contains the information about the picture in slightly different angles. And then turns in whatsoever. So actually, the material must of be transparent to the angle of incidence. Am I right? And do I see it?
I think that's true. Let's see what John has to say about all this. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
So I answer the comment.
The comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Bill. AC2IS, K2RIW.
Came through, I announced a couple times, hopefully I was not annoying you guys too much, but the crystallographer that originally got the image of DNA was Rosalind Franklin, and I believe that image was, back at the time, simply a set of X patterns of crossing, and published anyway. On the interference patterns that you get out of crystallography, something I think similar to the dual split experiments you can do, where you get a series of constructive and destructive intensities on, say, a photographic plate. Nowadays, you would record that sort of live video while rotating the object. Let me break for a second here. You'd be able to process that video of the interference pattern that you got on the other side. Back in the old days, this was a computational intensive task to go back to what the original protein looked like, but nowadays it's a relatively simple thing to do with software, or at least whether or not it's simple, it's a known process that we can do relatively quickly. AC2IS.
Yeah, PBS had a program about the discovery of the DNA helix. And the way I got the story is that Roslyn took that X-ray diffraction photograph. She was studying the helix. She was studying a DNA molecule. That photograph was in the drawer of her desk. Her boss was having a conference with Watson, who was visiting that facility. He decided to give a copy of that photograph to Watson without Rosalind's permission. And the first couple of times that Watson and Crick tried to come up with a working model that fit the data, the first couple of attempts were wrong. It was the second or third attempt to figure out what the helix looked like that finally was the one that that checked out. Some of their early attempts at making a model, and they had even announced that they had discovered it, and they had to retract because their first couple of attempts at figuring out what the helix looked like was wrong. Now, I don't think it was a double entwined helix on their very first attempt. I wonder if you saw that PBS program, Bill, AC2IS, K2RIW?
No, I did not see that program, but I was fortunate enough to hear the story from the man himself. I don't know how good my memory is. My recollection, I don't recall anything about a retraction, but certainly there were many revisions. And there was something about Linus Pauling having published something. I think one of his theories was a triple helix, which turned out to be completely wrong. But Watson and Crick, not only did they get the double helical shape of DNA, but also the nature of the ladder links between those helixes, the base pairs. I think in their what they published in their paper, one of those, the structure of one of those base pairs was reversed from what it actually was, but it turned out to be remarkably correct compared to what we know today, especially based on what information they had available to them at the time. AC2IS.
Yeah, certainly the model had been revised one, two, or three times. When I say the word retraction, maybe that's a little bit too strong. But inwardly, I think they had to admit that some of their early assumptions were not necessarily accurate and had to be modified. It was a fascinating story. And Rosalind doesn't get as much credit as some people think she deserves. But she also was not of the philosophy to freely share the data that she was gathering. She was a little bit more secretive, is one way of putting it. And I guess her boss overrode her philosophy without even asking her permission when he gave a copy of that photograph to Watson during Watson's visit. So there's a little bit of unfairness took place, but then again, the end justify the means is an interesting question here. Certainly, DNA and what it's doing now in law enforcement is certainly significant. Once again, tonight we've heard stories in the news of people, 60 Minutes, in fact, I mean, 60 Minutes, was interviewing people who been on death row, falsely accused of a crime, and by way of DNA, they found out they were innocent. So DNA is certainly very important. We've used up our time for tonight. We haven't settled anything. What else is new? That was TechNet number 1,584, and I think we're gonna try it again next week. Next week we're gonna settle all these things, aren't we, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Oh, absolutely. Tune in again next week for an exciting summation of everything that's wrong. We'll correct it all. I'd like to thank everybody for joining the net tonight, both on Echolink and on our Admiral. And for the questions, my email is available at qrzbaker5oscaroscar@aol.com. Any questions submitted, I will submit it, and we'll answer your question if possible. But a lot of fun. Good time. Dick, Paul, enjoy, and we'll talk again. So, keep it.
John, if I understand correctly, you are monitoring a chat room and you're monitoring Echolink. Are those two separate computer screens you're looking at, so to speak? John, go ahead.
Yes, Dick. Two separate computer screens that I'm looking at. The chat room is the question that Mark brought in. And then we had Joe on Echolink with his question. Simon.
Yeah, I think these computers are going to catch on. Computers, internet, RF, digital. I think it's all going to, something significant is going to happen here eventually. Bye-bye, you all. See you down the log. K2RIW, clear.
At 11 o'clock, I lost power here for 20 seconds. There was a big explosion, so I guess I'll be reading about it in the paper tomorrow. Something like that. But I was out of power for 20 seconds.
Yeah, my house was out of power for something like 5 minutes. Somewhere around 4 o'clock this afternoon, as I remember, because of a automobile striking a major power line in the area about a half a mile from my house. And when they brought the power back on, as you heard me guys say earlier, my voltage has been high ever since. At least I think it's higher than normal. 128.5 or 128.6 to me strikes me high. What's the highest voltage? Well, are you on two phases of three-phase power? Well, what does your line voltage normally run out there in Staten Island, John? Go ahead.
About 126 is my average. Most of the time. In the summertime, sometimes it goes down to 124, 123 in that area.
Okay, so I think you're saying you stay in a pretty small window, roughly 126 plus or minus 2 volts or so?
That's about right. Yeah, right there. And they do a pretty good job here.
Now, there are some people on Con Ed, like where Richie into EO used to live in Whitestone. His 220 was really a crazy number because it's two phases of a three-phase power system. Do you remember that one, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, whether he was on a Delta block or a Y, I'm not sure. More than likely, he was on a Y, and that can give you some crazy things, but that happens all over, and that's up to Edison, depending on which primary feeder you're coming off of and how they split it up, and also how they develop the three-phase for the neighborhood, whether they use two transformers and drive the third, or they actually have three actual transformers. It makes a difference.
So when an average American in the five boroughs of New York City talks about his 240 volt voltage, to your knowledge, what's the lowest voltage he might be saying if he had delta versus Y? What's the lowest and the highest voltage he might call his so-called 240? Over to you, John.
Well, I've seen that claim, and I've measured voltages up in the area close to 250 on some of it, and as low as like 230, 232 in that area.
And which one is the higher voltage, delta or Y?
I found that the Y division is the one that gives us the higher voltage. That's usually coming in and converted to like your 208 function, things like that. That's coming in on the Y.
Now run that by again. There's some people who are really getting 208 volts for what they call 240, 220.
Yes, there are places that do derive and come down with a 208 instead of like a 215. There's several different voltage variants, depending on also where the seasonal taps are set on the transformers.
Is 208 likely to be a delta connection for his local power?
Go ahead, Glenn.
It's a three-phase 208 is an industrial drop. So in other words, whatever the local high voltage on the street is, usually with three-phase 208, it's like an industrial type of power, where a lot of times if you see like buildings in hot pot, and you see those big transformers that are out on the big concrete slabs entering the building, there's no 115, 220 type of thing, where it's actually now 126, 250. Or 125, 250, which is kind of the standard for most of Long Island residential. But yeah, for industrial drops, it's very common to see three-phase 208 or 115 lines to neutral. It's all Y. Cases right here.
115 line to neutral would be giving me what voltage line to line? Square root of 2 times 140 times 115?
Which is kind of like the low end of the 208. It's typically 120, 120 times the square root of 3, which is 1.732. And that should give you something pretty close to 208.
I just did square root of 3 times 115. I may have made a mistake. I ended up with 199.
No mistake, Dick. You're right on. It's 120 times the square root of 3 is 208. 115 times the square root of 3 is basically the 200, which is the low line of 208.
Comment? Yeah, sure enough. I do get the 208, like you said. Comment, go ahead. Start off with your call letter's name, sir.
Hello, Dick. This is K1MJM, Mike number 2. I had rental space in an industrial park and the three legs on my three-phase service had 125, 125, and 208 volts.
Five.
Okay, yep. What made you say 185, John Grant?
That's when they have a high leg arrangement there, and Glenn will be able to explain it to you also. When you're bringing in that three-phase, and they're on an open delta, you can have a leg that is not used for the conventional wiring because it is at 185. And yeah, if the voltage goes up higher, it can approach 200.
Roger, it was marked as 208 and it measured 210.
Yeah, I mean, in most industrial applications here, especially up in the northeast and north power location, actually most of the United States for that matter, industrial 208 in the United States is wide because the attachment neutral is very close to the ground for safety agents. Very, very rare. Where you find delta a lot is in military and generator applications. So we have generators and a lot of military, you'll see delta, like 400 hertz delta. It's a very common three-phase, but for most utility power, it's typically a wide connection